I'm Fathery.
This is Dave.
And I'm Chris.
And this is Text Trek.
Engage.
So, Dave, it's been a long road.
Getting from there to here?
Yeah, but we've made it. This is the...
It's been a long road!
No, we don't need none of that.
Getting from there to here.
This is the...
It's been a long road!
Shut up!
Hey, you didn't think that was going to happen when you tried to throw me off with that.
I had a good idea it was going to happen.
But seriously, this is the fifth and final installment of Star Trek number ones, where we take a look of each premiere of each show to gauge how they stack up to Star Trek Discovery's premiere coming Sunday.
Yeah, yeah.
So less than a week away.
By the time folks are seeing this, it's going to be like a few days out probably. And shall we introduce our guest judge?
Yeah, so talking about Broken Bow, the first episode of Enterprise, with us, we have Chris here today. So Chris, go ahead and tell us how you got into Star Trek.
Well, my earliest memories of Star Trek, no.
In the womb.
Yeah. No, I actually remember watching it at my grandparents' house. Not the original series, but it was the cartoon.
Oh, the animated series.
Yeah, from the 70s. It had that random alien.
Now, you would not have been watching it in the 70s.
No.
Were you watching it like when Nickelodeon started rerunning it?
Didn't
they rerun it?
I guess so.
It was on a Saturday thing where I think they really showed old Saturday morning cartoons. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. I think it was on that block.
Yeah. So I remember watching that, and then I remember liking it. But probably like the first thing I remember like really enjoying Star Trek was I went to the Village Cinema 4 here in town and watched Star Trek 4. Which is still
legit.
Yeah,
that was my favorite one as a kid. Might still be now.
It might still be my favorite one because it has things that I really enjoy. It has time travel and whales. I don't know.
Well, you know what? It's like it was the ultimate. The crew getting to kind of to show off. At that point, everybody like loved all the members of the crew.
Yes,
and so you got to really enjoy them as an ensemble at that point. And there were still some emotional stakes too.
Sure,
I mean, you know. It was serious. There was serious stuff going on with Spock and all that.
There was, and I don't think I got that as a kid. I was like, why doesn't, like, Spock know Kirk? I was like, I didn't quite understand what was going on there. But
had you seen, like, Wrath of Khan or Star Trek 3?
I don't think I watched that until afterwards.
Interesting.
So I just remember watching that as a kid.
That would be slightly confusing.
Hmm. Yeah, but
to skip 2 and 3 and go straight to 4.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it happens all the time, basically, with other franchises, and so...
Yeah. And then I remember my sister getting really excited about a year later. There was going to be a new Star Trek show, and I was like, okay. So I watched it, and I really don't remember too much about Next Generation, that first season, or that first episode.
The mind can block out painful memories.
That's probably for the best.
Yeah, but I do remember the cool like Q scene where it's like the future...
Right, where he takes them to court, basically, it's like a tribunal or something.
Yeah, it's like Mad Max kind of, like, future. So that was my earliest memory, and I, you know, by the time I was in high school and everything, I was pretty much hooked on Next Generation, and I would, like, you know, tape the season premiere on the VCR.
Yeah. Any particular favorite episode that, like, just pops into your head, or favorite character or something?
Probably... the one where I think maybe it was like the last Wesley Crusher episode where he and Picard crash, like on
not the last one. I guess he was leaving.
Was the last one
where he was on the bridge.
As a regular. Yeah,
yeah, where he was a regular
in season 5.
Yep.
Where
Will
Wheaton had to quit working to go to college and turned out to be a mistake.
Yeah,
college is not always the answer.
Yes. And we never heard from Will Wheaton again. So
right. he's made a comeback.
Who?
It took a couple of decades, but he did it.
I believe Chris was being facetious.
Yes, there. Facetious.
Having worked at alongside me at the comic and game store,
yes.
We have some awareness of Will Wheaton's presence in our culture.
Yes. So, but I'll. So that's like my general Star Trek introduction, probably.
Why'd you like that episode in particular? Was it the survivalist thing?
I think it was the survival, and it was just the fact that
I was like survivalist.
Yeah, Picard kind of needed help, and I can't. It's been a while since I've watched Next Generation, but I tend to like the Klingon episodes where Worf.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, where Worf was like turned away. The Klingons like got rid of him, and he was like, I shouldn't do that to Worf. You know, he's going to end up, you know, just saving your butts, like.
Yep.
In a season or so.
Those were the episodes that were like, it was like they were trying real hard to make up for giving Worf the short end of the stick for like the first two or three seasons.
Yes. But he did tend to have like some of the funniest one-liners.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. And so Worf was, well, I like all the characters pretty much, but probably like Worf and Riker.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I played trombone in high school, and Riker played trombone. I was like, I could be on a starship.
You thought you were Riker?
Yes, that's exactly it.
Well, work on his chair straddle.
I try that. I just end up hurting myself.
Oh God!
You have to be at least 6'2" to attempt that.
Yeah. I was like, this was a really
baby chairs.
This was a really bad idea.
But that's next level Riker, isn't it?
Yes.
You've got to be an elite Riker to pull that off, and you know, not everybody can immediately.
Exactly.
Cool. Well, enough about Riker and those Next Generation scrubs. We're going back old school to before the original series.
When people wore ball caps.
Yeah, yes. When you wore ball caps on your ships.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Like the good old days of the 22nd century.
Mm-hmm. Are you going to summarize it for us?
Yeah, I'll go through a brief summary of this episode that aired September 20... September 26, 2001.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, because it was a Wednesday 2 weeks after 9/11.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. Wait, it was only 2 weeks after?
Yeah.
Wow.
And they already had, like, the Taliban?
That was a coincidence.
Wow. That's crazy. Okay. I thought it was actually, that was meant to be at least somewhat deliberately reflective.
It was.
Okay. That's some fast movement. That
was before, like, no one thought, like, oh yeah, we're actually going to go invade Afghanistan and kill the Taliban. It was just like, yeah, like, there's like
a threat on the radar now. Let's see what kind of stories we can tell loosely based on
it. I mean, it was just in the name was kind of like the only... initially, in the first episode, as we'll talk about.
All right, fire away. Let's hit it.
So the episode Broken Bow opens on a boy painting a model he built, and he's quoting Zephyrin Cochran's speech, "Where no man has gone before."
Mm-hmm.
This was really cool as a kid because I made Star Trek models of ships, and so it was cool to see the show start with a... Because I was like 15 when this aired, and so it was cool to see a young man...
You felt like you were a little Jonathan Archer.
Yeah, well, I was probably a little older than him, but he's talking about Ambassador Poynie's ship and the Enterprise to his dad. His dad is building this new ship, which we'll find out is the Enterprise.
Like a real ship, not a model.
Yeah, with a... new impressive engine, and the boy little Johnny has some problems with the ambassador. He calling him Ambassador Poynie, a very creative name, racial slur for
nice
Vulcans.
Kid. Yeah,
but we then cut to 30 years later, and a ship has crashed in the cornfields of Broken Bow, Oklahoma. We see a Klingon running through a cornfield while pursued by aliens discharging particle weapons. The Klingon takes cover in a silo. One of the aliens is able to flatten his body to squeeze under the door, and the aliens get in there. Klingon leaps out of the silo, rolls around on the ground, whips out his disruptor, and blows the silo up. Very dramatic explosion.
Mm-hmm.
And then the corn farmer confronts the Klingon, doesn't understand his Klingonese, and shoots him with a futuristic-looking shotgun.
Yes. Stand your ground laws.
We then cut to the worst opening credit sequence in Star Trek history.
You know what? We're going to talk about that more.
It's
been a long road!
No, we're not doing that. Everyone fast-forwards through that. That's like a universally known thing. Everyone fast-forwards through the Enterprise opening
not
sequence.
Me.
The show cuts back to space, where we see Captain Jonathan Archer, now as an adult, and the engineer Trip Tucker. They're floating around a little pod looking at the Enterprise, which is finishing construction, getting prepared to launch. Trip bumps the pod. They're flying around into the ship and scratches the paint.
That's why he's not the pilot.
They get a phone call from Earth.
A phone call?
Yeah, pretty much.
Hello?
The captain is needed at Starfleet Medical immediately. So we then see Starfleet Medical in San Francisco, and there is the Klingon from the teaser is laying in a hospital bed in this compound. We have some admirals. These admirals have names like Admiral Forrest, Admiral Leonard, there's a Commander Williams.
Yeah, I missed that.
There is a Vulcan, Ambassador Saval, who we know that Jonathan Archer didn't like as a little kid.
Yeah.
There's also a Vulcan named T'Pol and a Vulcan named Tos, T-O-S.
That's interesting. And they're all kind of a little bit a-holes.
Yeah, they're all kind of a-holes. But Archer shows up, and Admiral Forrest, he's the top-ranking Starfleet Admiral. He's letting him know that the Vulcans want to handle this. They have this Klingon, this alien who crashed on their planet. No one on Earth has ever seen a Klingon before. He has sustained severe injuries, and the Vulcans plan to return his corpse to the Klingon homeworld Kronos. They plan to take him off of life support. They claim that the Klingons value death and in duty, and they should just let him die and take the corpse back to Kronos.
Right.
And it doesn't sit well with Captain Archer. He says, no, this happened on our soil. We don't need to listen to these Vulcans. They've been holding us back. My dad was trying to build the Warp 5 engine. He died before he could see the ship launched. I can take the ship. I can take this man back to his homeworld alive. And the Admiral is convinced. The Vulcans don't like it. Captain Archer promises that he'd have the ship ready to go in 3 days.
Right. And they make a point that he is not... It's otherwise was not quite ready to roll. He's going to have to, like, hustle his ass to make it work. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the Admiral tells Archer, don't screw this up.
Right. Clearly a lot riding on it.
Yes.
This is literally their first major, like, fast warp drive ship.
Warp 4.5 in like 3 days or whatever.
And, and then they've got this, you know, precarious thing between with the Klingons, who are a warlike race. And the Vulcans are all watching them angrily.
Mm-hmm. We then cut to the Enterprise and meet the helmsman, Travis Mayweather, and the tactical officer, Malcolm Reed. Trip is on board. They're all preparing the ship for launch. We also learned that the transporter on the show is a new piece of technology that a lot of people aren't comfortable with using. We see Brazil, where we meet Hoshi Sato teaching a Vulcan language class, and Archer shows up to recruit her, and she's going to be the communications officer. The Vulcans agree to give Enterprise star charts so they can reach Kronos, but they have a condition with that. They have to send one of their own, so they send the Vulcan T'Pol, a female Vulcan that we saw earlier in the episode. Trip and Archer meet T'Pol, and she comes off as
quickly and condescending.
Yeah.
So like a Vulcan.
Yeah. Although worse than your typical Vulcan.
The show did take a very deliberate decision to amplify the Vulcan's paternalism.
Yes.
With this series. And we'll talk about it more in depth, I'm sure.
Sure.
But it was definitely a thing.
She doesn't even like the dog, though, Porthos.
Because of the sense of smell.
Yeah, is that a thing, or did they just kind of throw it in that scene?
That Vulcan females have a heightened sense of smell.
Yeah,
that was never brought up before this episode of Enterprise.
I assumed it was kind of there just to show that Captain Archer kind of was being a little belligerent about having the dog around her.
But
that's what we call a microaggression, by the way.
Microaggression.
I'm just saying.
But, you know, if you can't get along with, like, that cute beagle, then the problem's with you.
You know, could she give it, like, the Vulcan neckband and, like, knock it out?
I think so.
Put it to sleep.
Spock gave the Vulcan neck pinch to a horse on in Star Trek V.
Yeah.
On Nimbus 3.
I completely forgot that, but
so,
okay.
Wow. I guess you could do it to a dog.
Yeah. Okay. Noted for the future.
But we then get the ship launched. Admiral Forrest plays footage of Zefren Cochrane giving the speech from the commencement of the Warp 5 complex. This engine will let us go boldly where no man has gone before. I hate that. He should say boldly go, because I don't care about grammar.
yeah, the slight tweak to it is proper grammar. It's probably this is probably a case where Star Trek's tradition is so drummed into our head that it would be they should have let it stand.
Yes. Yeah.
And here's my
thing.
On the
other hand, I kind of don't care. It doesn't bother me. Like
I think they wanted to change it intentionally because TOS said to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Mm-hmm.
Next Generation updated it to where no one has gone before.
Yeah.
And so with Enterprise, they're probably thinking, well, we need to make it something a little different. Why don't we just fix the grammar?
Where none of my dogs have been before.
That is true. That's probably Porthos, I'm sure, is the first Earth dog to go many of the places where he went. So as the ship is preparing to take off from dry dock, Archer has a flashback to when he was a little kid building his model ship with his dad. And he says to the helmsman, Travis, take her out, Mr. Mayweather, straighten city. And the ship warps out of the Sol system. We then cut to this strange alien helix made up of a lot of small little pods joined together in this strange atmosphere just floating there. And one of the aliens from the opening that we saw chasing the Klingon is in this room talking to a mysterious figure kind of being projected in like a hologram. And they discuss what happened with the Klingon Kling, and the alien asks the mysterious figure if he can prevent the death of the soldiers that were pursuing Kling, implying there's some type of time alteration shit going down.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, on Enterprise, Dr. Phlox, who we saw this alien doctor tending to the Klingon in the Starfleet medical compound, he's tagged along. He seems to like humans. He thinks they're kind of quaint and interesting.
He sort of seems perpetually bemused.
Yes. Yeah, and he has a very interesting sick bay full of strange creatures. Maybe, possibly, it would fall under the definition of alternative medicine.
Yes.
Except this actually seems to work.
Right, right.
But, yeah, they have Klang on board. Phlox is tending to him. And we also learn that Phlox really likes humans because he loves Chinese food.
Right.
Travis and Trip are hanging out in the sweet spot of the ship where you can hang out on the ceiling, basically, the part where the gravity plating is weird.
I thought it was a neat idea.
That was
actually something that they intended to use a lot, but then they found out it was such a pain in the ass to get the actors
to fake zero-G.
Yeah, and it was just... They
I did actually wonder,
it.
Did they actually do that vomit comet plane that lets them do that, or was it all just, like, ropes?
No, I'm sure it was just, like, with ropes.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
And really all you'd have to do is, just, like, show them, like, get up there. After that, you can just, like, shoot them with the camera upside down.
Yeah. Do close-ups, but yeah, anyway, they decided not to do.
We learn a little bit more about the characters. We learn Travis is a space boomer. He's the first generation of humans born in space. His family had a cargo ship.
So he's been around.
Yeah, he's been around space more than typical humans at this point, even Starfleet officers. They reuse a joke from Aliens about the movie Aliens, about three-breasted aliens.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
We have T'Pol having dinner with Trip and Archer, and she's eating a vegetarian option while Trip and Archer eat these really delicious-looking giant steaks with baked potatoes.
She gets the last laugh. She cuts her breadstick with her fork and knife.
Yes.
But, we established that humans have transcended things like war and disease and poverty, and T'Pol still thinks of them as somewhat primitive.
Right. She does say, she's like, how can you think of yourself as advanced when you're still consuming dead animals or whatever? And Archer's attitude is sort of, we're getting there. It's not going to happen overnight. We hit the big stuff.
And then the ship is continuing on its way to the Klingon homeworld Kronos, and Klang regains consciousness, the Klingon Klang.
Oh, yeah.
He's speaking gibberish, though. You know, it's in Klingon, but it still doesn't make sense. Hoshi can't translate it. And suddenly, Enterprise is forced out of warp and starts losing power.
Yeah.
And the creepy aliens we've seen earlier in the episode are sneaking on board, crawling
super
on the
cool
walls and ceilings.
Scene. Yes.
And they have this cool shot of like what they're seeing with their infrared vision.
And they're like scuttling along the walls like bugs.
Yeah, and this is where we hear Klang call them Suliban. When they get into sickbay, they start fighting with Archer and one of these red shirt security guards that are in there. Archer is able to shoot one of them dead, but another one escapes with Klang. Power has been restored, but the Klingon is gone. So later on the bridge, T'Pol says to Archer they should return to Earth. The mission is a failure, but he's determined to find Klang. He pulls her aside into his ready room and vents all of his frustrations towards Vulcans at her, possibly unfairly, but...
Right,
yeah. You know, he explains, you know, his dad, Henry Archer, never got to see his engine utilized. He died just wanting to let's try out this engine, see if we can actually go warp 5. So he spent, like, his whole life just angry at Vulcans, not letting humans go and accomplish the...
Is the notion that the Vulcans held out on technology that could have helped them, like, why didn't you give us the tech? Or that they were, like, saying, you know, like, rules of space travel are such that you can't go warping around like maniacs?
Well, it's implied that, yeah, like, the Vulcans weren't giving them much help, maybe occasionally would, but also, like, Vulcans would be, advising them not to do this.
Right. Like, it's sort of like being on the other edge of the Prime Directive, being the planet that that can't get the full help because they're too primitive.
Yes, like, the Vulcans were like, you're not ready for what's out there, so we're not going to give you this technology.
Yeah, and Archer's tired of being held back, humanity being held back by Vulcans. He feels that the humanity is... unable to progress because of Vulcan interference. Dr. Phlox is in sickbay performing an autopsy on the dead Suliban that Archer shot and discovers that he's received abilities from advanced genetic enhancements. T'Pol and Trip have investigated some of these sensor logs. They detected something before they lost power and possibly might be able to track some ships down. Apparently, Klang had been to the Rigel system right before he came to Earth, and the humans weren't told that initially by the Vulcans when they recovered the sensor log from that ship. They're just now learning this.
Right, the Vulcans are holding out.
Yeah, so frustrated Archer decides, okay, well, let's go to Rigel 10. It would have been nice if y'all told us that earlier. So we cut back to the Suliban Helix, where Klang is being interrogated under the influence of some type of truth serum. He confesses that he went to Rigel 10 to meet with a Suliban female named Saren and was supposed to receive a message, but he didn't actually get anything from her. He has nothing to deliver. Back on Enterprise, the crew prepare for a landing mission on Rigel 10. T'Pol informs the members of the landing party that... Dr. Phlox recommends they don't make any intimate contact on the planet. Like, I'm not sure why...
No shore leave fooling around.
Yeah, I don't know like why you'd have to like warn people of that. Like, what does Phlox think about humans? And he's like, I better bring this up. They might get STDs. Anyways, they land on this dark, snowy planet, Rigel 10, and they're in some kind of strange industrial marketplace where the Coors Light twins are doing bad sexy dancing and eating butterflies with frog tongues.
Yes, that was just strange.
T'Pol is asking around and finds out that there is an enclave where Klingons are known to hang out and eat live food. Archer and Hoshi proceed to that area, but they're grabbed up by these hooded Sulabans. The Sulabans have also captured T'Pol and Trip, and Archer meets this Suliban female Saren that we heard Klang mention earlier. She approaches him in the form of a human female and asks what Archer is doing with Klang. He explains they simply want to take him home. Saren kisses Archer and then turns into her natural Suliban form, which kind of freaks Archer out.
His line, that's never happened before.
Yeah.
It was actually a pretty good line.
Yes.
So. And nicely, dryly delivered.
But she explains that she was a part of the Suliban Cabal, where they receive genetic enhancements as payment. They're soldiers fighting for a faction in a temporal Cold War. They're taking orders from the future. And she has the ability to, I guess, tell if someone's being honest or not by touching them, and that's why she decided to kiss Archer.
Sure.
Yeah,
it's like how Starfire and Teen Titans would kiss people to learn what their different languages and stuff. Actually, in that, they always made the point, she didn't have to, that was just her preferred method.
Well, apparently, Saren and Starfire have that in common.
Yep.
But she explains to Archer that the Suliban Cabal, they've been staging these attacks to make it look like different Klingon factions are attacking each other, and they're trying to instigate a Klingon civil war. And Klang is secretly carrying proof back to the Klingon High Council. She asks Archer if her Suliban here on Rigel 10 can go with them to get Klang. They'll help him look for him and get him to Kronos. But then suddenly they're attacked by the Cabal Sulabans, and she is shot and killed, and dies asking Archer to find Klang, get him to Kronos. Archer, Hoshi, Trip, and T'Pol make their way back to Travis and Reed on the shuttle pod, and the captain is wounded trying to get T'Pol on board, and he's been shot in the leg, passes out on the shuttle pod. While they're returning up to Enterprise, T'Pol claims she's taking command of Enterprise, and unconscious Archer dreams of flying his model ship with his dad on the beach, and it crashes in the sand. His dad's telling him, "You can't be afraid of the wind." Back on the ship, Trip and T'Pol are required to sexily rub gel on each other in the decontamination chamber.
Maybe one of the most forced acts of forced attempts by Star Trek to sexy it up.
Yeah, they don't have decontamination showers in the future.
At the same time, I can't deny the power of her nipples. what is funny though, of course, about that whole scene is they make a point. They're very businesslike about it,
It's true.
They're rubbing each other down, but kind of arguing the whole time.
Yeah, but there
not
are
like,
little moments where like they kind of like pause what they're saying. It's like
they can't resist.
There's implied some
a little bit of
there's
little
some
bit of magnetism.
Sexual attraction,
right?
Overlapping the dramatic tension as they're arguing, and actually there's a later episode where Trip. Mentions we actually meets T'Pol's mom,
mm-hmm.
and she asks, "How long have you been in love with my daughter?" And he says, "I guess I knew it like the first time we argued." So I think he was actually talking about this moment.
That's pretty funny. But by the way, cosplay ideas for both of them. I don't know if anybody's ever done that. You gotta like
rubbing gel,
greased up in your underwear for both Trip and T'Pol cosplayers.
That's a really
considerate
good gel too.
Cosplayers if you haven't already.
It'd be easy to do, but. Yeah. They are arguing about, T'Pol is taking over command of Enterprise. Trip is saying how, it's going to be important that you don't make us end the mission. You don't return us to Earth. This is really important to the captain. He just wants to see this through. His dad was the same way. He wanted to test out his engine, and you people didn't even give him a chance to fail. He died not seeing his engine tested. Don't do the same thing to his son. We get to sick bay where Archer's leg injury has been healed by Phlox's eel.
Yeah.
More
eel treatments.
T'Pol and Trip show up and they inform Archer that they have modified the sensors to track the Suliban warp trail. They've identified the plasma decay or whatever, Trechnobabble. And they're in pursuit of the ship. Archer is impressed that T'Pol chose to continue the mission instead of returning to Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So Enterprise tracks the ship to a Class 7 gas giant, and with some more sensor modifications from T'Pol, the crew sees that multiple Suliban ships have entered the gas giant recently. Archer orders weapons to be charged and hull plating polarized. They're going into the gas giant. And this is where the Suliban Helix is, and we see the mysterious shadowy figure who is, we can now conclude, is a guy from the future.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone calls him Future Guy, which actually started immediately after this episode aired. People were calling him Future Guy on the internet. he orders the Suliban leader, Silic, to stop the humans. They can't be allowed to interfere with what he intends to do with the Klingon Empire and start this Klingon Civil War. So Enterprise descends into the gas giant. They pass through a few different levels. They enter a level of liquid phosphorus. And under that layer...
It'll look a little bit like the Mutara Nebula for a little while. Not exactly, but you get rid of it. It's gaseous.
Yes. Yeah. Under the layer of the liquid phosphorus is where the Suliban Helix is. And they capture one of the little Suliban pod ships with their cool grappler. I love that idea that they didn't have a tractor beam. This is before that. They have an actual physical grappler that has to go and hook onto something and reel it back in. So they capture one of those pods. The pilot ejects himself, but they bring it on board. And Lieutenant Reed gives Archer a device to knock out the magnetic locks on the helix and make all the little Suliban pods disconnect and break up their giant helix. He also gives them the new experimental weapon, the phase pistol. Mm-hmm. Which is cool because it has a stun feature and a kill feature.
Well, don't get those mixed up.
Trip and Archer pilot the captured pod down to the Suliban helix and dock with it. Trip still, as he's docking, if you notice, he still like bumps into it and probably scratches some more paint.
It was a nice little callback.
Crap-ass pilot.
That's why he's an engineer.
They get on board the Helix and they proceed through some dark corridors. They test out the stun feature, finds out it works on a Suliban that tries to confront them. They finally reach the interrogation room that Klang is locked up in. They remove him from the restraints. He's not too cooperative at first, but you know, finally agrees to leave with them and even helps them fight their way out. Archer arms the anti-maglock device as Trip and Klang get on the pod. They Helix pods all start to disconnect from the device, and Archer orders Trip to take Klang back to the ship. He says, "You can come back and get the Klingon out of here." So Enterprise is up in the liquid phosphorus level. They're having to move around to avoid like these depth charges that are being shot up into their level of the atmosphere. Trip can't find them, but Hoshi uses her magic ear on the communications station. She can hear like this faint transmission, and so they're able to get Trip and Klang back on board. Archer's still walking around the Helix, and he makes his way into the room where you go to talk to Future Guy. And Silic is in there. This is where we see Silic and Archer kind of confront each other. Silic tells him, you know, just go, just leave. And this is like a special effect that didn't really work, where he shoots the phase pistol at Archer, but like Archer like spins out of the way. The idea is that like this future room has kind of like a reverse echo, where like you see and hear something like right before you see and hear it. And so like Archer saw like the beam coming before the beam was coming.
It almost looks like it strikes him, but it's like the that was just like the little primer laser or whatever.
What it was supposed to be was like he was, because in that room it's like a reverse echo, like you. You see the echo before the event happens.
Right. Yes.
So he saw the beam coming before the beam was coming.
Right.
But
he gets out of the way, and then there's this weird like backwash effect.
It's very kind of like Matrixy.
I have to say, it does look pretty neat. But I was like, did they say what I'm supposed to be seeing here? Like,
it was a total Brannon Braga idea that sounds cool on paper, but the execution didn't really.
It didn't sell the concept.
I think it would work actually in like. If it was like in a novel in prose, where like,
right, where you knew you sort of what technically was going on,
So, anyways, they start fighting each other, rolling around, fighting over the phase pistol, and we see like this cool thing that Silic does with his hand as him and Archer are still fighting over the phase pistol, where he can like. Roll his hand around.
Of a T-1000 thing, but it seems like they're not quite that. He can't just completely morph, but he can bend his bones and kind of reverse things.
It was neat. Something we hadn't really seen before, especially in Star Trek. But Silic grabs the phase pistol, and as he's about to shoot Archer, he's beamed out back to the Enterprise.
Right. First use of the transporter technology on a person.
That we know.
Canonically, it's probably not, but this is the first time that Archer had probably ever been beamed, and the first time that the NX-01 Enterprise had used its transporter on a person. Then we get to Kronos, finally. The Klingons are in the council chamber shouting at each other, and Hoshi, Archer, T'Pol, and Klang walk in. The Klingons see Klang, one of them grabs a knife, slices open his hand, gets a little bit of blood and a vial. Puts it in the computer, and they see that there is actually a message encoded on Klang's DNA.
Yeah.
And so the Klingons now have their proof that the Suliban were staging attacks. Mm-hmm. The appears to be the Klingon leader says something to Archer. We don't know what it is, but we know it's not thank you.
It might end in you.
We get back to Enterprise, the captain's ready room. Archer is talking to Trip and T'Pol, tells them that Admiral Forrest is pleased with the results of the mission, and has ordered them to remain in space and go out and explore. Archer says he was wrong about T'Pol. You know, he says that, you know, I had some preconceived notions that I need to get over, and, you know, I couldn't have done this without you. Mm-hmm. And T'Pol's like, I know. But he says that, you know, it might be good if you stayed on board and served as science officer. But then he's like, I don't want to sound like a little bitch and, like, ask the Vulcans, like, can I please have her as a science officer? So could you, like, ask for me?
Yes, yeah.
And she's like, yeah, I can ask.
I don't think you used that exact terminology, but that was the implication. Yes,
paraphrasing. Yeah, but she agrees to stay, and Archer steps out onto the bridge, orders Travis to set a course to a nearby unexplored world. Travis mentions there's an ion storm on the way, but Archer tells him, can't be afraid of the wind. Take us to warp 4. And we end on little kid Johnny and his daddy flying his model ship.
Right, even as we know, it's come to fruition in the present.
So, that was the first episode of Star Trek Enterprise. Chris, what do you think about that episode?
It's my favorite pilot of all the Star Trek shows.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah, every time I watch it, I'm like, I get really like, oh, I'm going to watch all of Enterprise now. And then
you do. You watch every time.
All 98 episodes.
Yes. Is it 98 episodes? Wow. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe something closer to like 20 or 30, and then you're...
Yeah. So, but no, I like a lot of things in it. I like the kind of the chemistry between Trip and T'Pol and Archer. I like all just like their little moments they have together. So.
You know, having the dinner together,
yes,
is both kind of like a very, it's another one of those down to earth things.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also a good place for them to, they can A, do exposition, and B, do mm-hmm. character conflict and stuff like that. And so yeah, I completely agree.
They do a lot of those dinner scenes throughout the entire course of the show.
They do, yeah. I think that was a good thing that they threw in right from the beginning.
Yeah, and another thing is just cool aliens. It works.
Suliban were among the cooler threat aliens that we'd seen in a
while. Yeah, and they set off at like the very beginning. Like one of them like kind of like shrinks down and goes underneath a door.
Right, it's which like was he really flattens cool. himself.
Uh-huh. And then we have cool like Klingon moments where he like, you know, the very beginning just blows up the silo or whatever. So
He got to do the leap away from the explosion in slow motion.
He did. Yeah.
It's a full-on action hero thing.
It was pretty awesome. And
considering that ultimately that scene was about him getting shot, he got to be a badass beforehand.
He did, yeah. And one of the main things I just like about the pilot is there's a mystery, and they give us enough that we're like still kind of interested, but we still don't know future guy. So there's a lot going on that I enjoyed, and there's some cool action and there's some failed sexiness that just kind of feels a little out of place. But overall, I really enjoyed it. Yeah.
Dave, what did you think?
It is also among my favorite of the pilots. I remember liking it right out of the gate when it came out. I also, that was at a time when I think I didn't have a lot of patience necessarily for Trek, and so I probably only watched, I'm going to say, a season and a half before I kind of just fell away from keeping up with it. I don't know what was going on in 2005, but I was busy or something. 2006 then? I don't know.
It ended in 2005.
Oh, okay, so 2001. Actually, I would, very, very honestly, I would have been setting up the store right in those days, and so there's a good reason why I might have been busy. But anyway, rewatching it, one of the things that struck me is that it's not like, Encounter at Farpoint and some of the other ones are, I think, a little bit trying to push, certainly Deep Space Nine too, the sort of the science fiction notions of Star Trek. They have the somewhat loftier notions. Where I think Enterprise particularly is effective is it's more like the movies tend to be, where it's like a compelling sort of suspense and action drama. It's more emotional, it's a little heavy-handed, but Archer has a very clear-cut emotional arc. Mm-hmm. He has to get over his issues with the Vulcans. T'Pol has to kind of learn to trust the humans and back their plays. There's some great action sequences throughout, starting with the Klingon one, great infiltration sequence, pretty cool shootout on whatever that icy planet was.
Rigel 10.
On Rigel 10. Yeah. And a good action sequence at the end with a little bit of weird time blurring stuff. So I feel like it really works strongly on a gut level, even if it's not necessarily pushing the science fiction boundaries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
what about you?
I'm
going to
bounce off of that and say, like, it is very cinematic.
Right.
Yes.
It's one of the most cinematic episodes of Star Trek.
Generally speaking, don't you think maybe stronger action than they had traditionally had? Is
yeah, and they were definitely going for that. This was after Rick Berman had been working in the 24th century with Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, and Voyager for 14 years consecutively. And so this was going to be a major departure at the time when they go back to what you often refer the rough and tumble Kirk era, even though this is before Kirk, but they wanted to they wanted to
get into key off of that
into that type of stuff, and
having
more action was going to be part of that. I remember reading interviews with Rick Berman and Brandon Braga like that summer leading up to the September premiere online, and they said, you know, this captain, he might be a little bit more likely to drop kick someone. Pull out the phasers than Picard or anyone else.
I actually remember throughout the first season, Archer kind of got his butt kicked a lot.
He did, yeah.
But he was also a little quick. He's kind of quick to anger at times. Not a hothead per se, but he could get riled up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one of my big problems with Enterprise is that over the course of the show, I think he's written very inconsistently. Mm-hmm. And
you think it's sort of like what they wanted to emphasize at any moment he became?
Yeah. Like sometimes they try to make him into like, you know, a big badass, and then sometimes he comes off as like kind of dumb. He doesn't, like, he gets fooled or something. And I think it was an interesting character that they created specifically for Scott Bakula. He's the only time the captain didn't have to audition. They
built a show around him, basically.
Yeah, they wrote the character for him, and I think a big part of that was just, you know, his presence on Quantum Leap is where most people, you know, knew him. And there are some similarities to, what's the name of the character? Sam, what's his last name?
Beckett?
Yeah, Sam Beckett.
I've never seen an episode of Quantum Leap. Well,
okay.
He's kind of a similar character, though. He kind of has, like this naive curiosity. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of really worked for Archer with the, you know, the story they were telling, like, this is humanity's first time going out into space, and you know,
you think having a little naivete was in the humans was kind of a good representation of that.
Yeah, like when he was like, well, I hope we never have to use the phasers again.
very ironically,
phase cannons or whatever.
Like, here's hoping that's the last fight we get into.
Yeah,
well, and the humans, they're also like, for like the first half of the pilot, they're like, we can handle it, and they get to that kind of ice planet. And they're all, like, wide-eyed, like, what's going on? So
they even make a point that when Trip is about to go and interfere, there's, like, a mother using a little breather unit on her, like, infant kid. Or it seems like it's mother. And but the kid is coughing and looks all desperate. And it seems like she's holding back the respirator. And Trip is like, he's like a concerned parent at Walmart. He's like, I'm going to go give that guy some what for. Yeah. Or that mom some what for. And then T'Pol is like, chill your ass out. This is how their species acclimates to like a non-methane atmosphere. It's got to happen, and this is normal thing. And she's like, you need to learn when to interfere and when not to.
Yeah,
which is interesting thematically. You know, if you broadly take the Federation as an analog to America, or to, you know, thinking about any sort of global interference, global adventurism. It's an interesting point. Maybe the Vulcans were right to hold out a little bit on technology. Mm-hmm. It is interesting to see the flip side of that, because, you know, usually you see these cultures and you're like, man, the Federation does not need to go get in there and give them technology because they're going to just use it to amp their war effort or whatever. Yeah. And they do, you know, Archer does make the point that they've kind of They've stopped war, you know. They've like they seem to have resolved the major crises of Earth and come back from a you know, global devastation to do that. But, you know, to stick up for the paternalistic Vulcans, it might have been reasonable for them to give us a little bit of a waiting period before they gave us all the tech.
And that was another neat idea, was that they wanted to show humanity, you know, definitely had made progress towards that, you know, idealistic Gene Roddenberry, Picard era, you know, future human utopia. Mm-hmm. But they weren't quite there. And they also did like the same thing with the Vulcans. The Vulcans weren't quite the noble species we had seen.
Right.
If anything, they were more similar to the TOS Vulcans, where you know Spock would occasionally be condescending to humans, or you know Sarek of Vulcan was kind of condescending to non-Vulcans.
Right.
They kind of like really dialed that up as, okay, if we're going to take them earlier than that and see them where they're even less evolved.
It's probably a little bit of a stretch to have merely 10 years before Kirk that the Vulcans were fairly notably culturally different. You know, you would think that that would change
this
over a span
this
of...
This is 110 years before Kirk.
Oh, wait, is it that far?
Yeah.
God, I forgot. It's the new show, of course, that's only 10 years. I forgot it was that much. Okay.
Yeah. This is in the year 2151.
Criticism rescinded. That's yeah. But broadly speaking, you would expect that you know culture to change, especially over centuries, especially with, as they note, a long-lived race like the Vulcans. Archer makes an interesting point at some point. He's like, "You guys live 200 years. We don't. We don't have time to sit around and wait."
Yeah.
Yeah.
That reminded me a little bit of the sort of like the way Tolkien's elves are, you know, they're essentially immortal. So they take a fairly laid back, chill view of, global, Middle Earth politics most of the time, except when they're pushed. And it seems like they were running the Vulcans a little bit like that.
Sure. And I kind of like to have it with like humanity having a little bit of a chip on their shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
Like we're going to go explore, and it just, I don't know, kind of reminded me of kind of the 1960s, kind of like we're going to go to the moon, kind of space race.
Yeah, that was definitely a big inspiration for Star Trek in the 60s. That was part of the zeitgeist.
And is visually referenced during the beautiful song that opens every single episode.
I don't know
is
what you're talking about.
It's a beautiful song, though.
You know,
so let's talk about that,
Dave. Let's talk about this. All right. I'm going to say it's more of a guilty pleasure than anything else. I'm going to allow it's a super hokey song. Mm-hmm. But I there's something about it where I actually do usually watch it when it comes on. I think it's the imagery of 60s and 70s era NASA space exploration merged with the song. It's a catchy enough little folksy kind of song.
Have you ever heard the original like Rod Stewart version?
Ah.
You might... Not you actually might not like it as much if you're so attached to this.
Was it actually a Rod Stewart song?
This was a Rod Stewart song on the soundtrack to the Robin Williams movie Patch Adams.
Interesting.
Wow.
You know, you're saying that, and it's ringing a bell now. I knew, in the back of my head, I remembered it was a Rod Stewart song. And it sounds like the kind of ballads he did, which I consider like... You know, there's Rod Stewart of the 70s where he's like, his songs are all kind of tawdry sex songs.
Yes.
And then like in the 80s and 90s, he kind of veered into adult contemporary.
Yeah.
And this is I won't lie, it's a kind of soft rocky adult contemporary song. It's like if you liked Phil Collins in the 90s and all that
You like music that doesn't have any balls to it, then listen to this.
Yeah. That you're such a tough guy with the music.
Yeah, well, no, when I was listening to it, I was like, is that Rod Stewart? And I was like, it sounds kind of like a Rod Stewart wannabe.
It's a cover.
Yeah.
But
I like seeing that transition.
The images are good,
right? They take they run a transition from 60s era exploration to Zefram Cochrane's first ship to do warp to with some space shuttle stuff in between, and eventually to the present Enterprise, the NX-01.
Yeah,
and I think we can all agree on that. I'm not going to necessarily try and win anybody over on the song. I'm just saying I'm a dissenter, and I'd like to hear from all the audience members who are dissenters too.
But you
we're going to go listen to some soft rock together. We're going to listen to some Hollow Notes. It's going to be a good time.
No, you could have had like all that cool imagery and all the emotion that comes with that without that song. And a big reason why people hate it is it's not like the quality of the song is irrelevant. It could be like the best
they wanted song orchestral. Ever.
Yeah, but the people
orchestral,
wanted orchestral.
Jerry Goldsmith.
You know? This was a really weird thing with Enterprise, where they were deliberately saying, you know, we're going to do things very differently this time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was after 14 years, okay, well, we did Next Generation was basically kind of the same premise as the original series. You're on the Enterprise exploring space.
Mm-hmm.
You know, DS9, let's stick people in one spot on a space station. Voyager, let's strand them on the other end of the galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, what else can we do? And they're like, let's get out of this time period. Let's really shake things up. Let's not even put Star Trek in the name of the show. For a while, the show was just called Enterprise, not Star Trek Enterprise.
Right. Interesting.
That's something like after the ratings were dropping, like the network was like, no, like we need to brand this as Star Trek.
People need to know it's Star Trek.
let's get rid of like the orchestral opening. Let's do like something completely different. Let's have like this cool montage. Let's put some hip music that the kids are into. And it was just a lot of the stuff that they did to change things didn't work. We were talking about the sleazy attempts to sex things up. Right. I can't remember if it was Berman or Braga. I think it was Rick Berman. But in one interview I read online that year, he said, we're going to push the envelope as far as sex on TV goes with this show.
Yeah.
It just comes off as just, like, kind of desperate. It's like,
right. In anime, it's what they call fan service. The cheesy panty shots and stuff like that in anime. I'll say this. I feel like that the basic concept of that scene, characters undergoing decontamination and kind of having a spat slash kind of bond.